Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hi, everyone. I'm Elise Gallus, and today I'm excited to share the most recent gospel gathering we did just last month with Dr. Craig Keener on the historical reliability of the Gospels. In case you aren't already familiar with Craig Keener, he is a professor at Asbury Seminary and is known for his work as a New Testament scholar on Bible background. I know you're going to enjoy hearing Dr. Keener give this fascinating talk on the genre of the Gospels, Christobiography, memory and oral tradition, and even the role of miracles in the Gospels. So enjoy part one of Craig Keener's March 2023 talk, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels.
We're looking at the historical reliability of the Gospels. A bit of a change in topic, but actually the Gospels and Acts tell us about the work of the Holy Spirit, the coming of the kingdom that's already not yet. So knowing that they're historically reliable sources is important. Now, as Christians, we start with a default trust in the Gospels. But how do we explain that to a secular audience that sometimes starts with default agnosticism, sometimes worse? I was an atheist before my conversion, and there are friendly atheists, and then the kind of atheists who make fun of people. I was the latter, but was converted through an encounter with the Holy Spirit after some people shared the gospel with me. They didn't have all this information. In fact, when I asked them if there was a God, where did the dinosaur bones come from? You ask a stupid question, you get a stupid answer. They said the devil put them there. So they were trained neither in paleontology nor in apologetics, but but they did give me the gospel, and then the Holy Spirit took it from there. But it is helpful. I struggled with a lot of questions after my conversion because a lot of things weren't answered on that day in particular. So what I want to do, we announced that part of this was going to be about Christobiography, which was a book I wrote dealing with the genre of the Gospels. And that's relevant to this broader topic of the historical reliability of the Gospels. What were the Gospel writers trying to do? Were they trying to write novels? Were they trying to write history? Were they trying to write science fiction, poetry, bomb threats? You know, the different kinds of genres that we can look at. So we want to look first at the genre of the Gospels. We also want to look at, okay, by the time the Gospels were written, did everybody forget everything? There's one book that's very popularly spread that says, well, they couldn't have remembered things for all these decades before the Gospels were written down. So we also need to look at memory and oral tradition. Would people have remembered things that long? And then we want to look at evidence in the Gospels for early memories. And then one of the major objections, it was actually the original objection to why the Gospels and Acts were not considered reliable, because like one third of the Gospel of Mark consists of miracles and one fifth of the book of Acts consists of miracles. And so some people have said, well, obviously that can't come from eyewitnesses because eyewitnesses would never claim that. And my response to that is, really? So I want to look at that too as we have time. Some of this will be in the afternoon after lunch. So what are the Gospels? Through most of history, people assumed that these were lives or memoirs, which is kind of biographically related works. But in the early to mid-1900s, Bultmann and the form critics noticed that the Gospels were not like modern biographies and therefore said, they're not really biographies. By now, however, most scholars have decided that they were biographies after all. They were just ancient biographies, which are written a little bit differently than modern biographies. But One of the problems with fads and fashions, including in scholarship, is that people who think that they know everything because they've been properly educated, sometimes the fads and fashions a few generations later get refuted. But anyway, the Gospels are ancient and not modern biographies. Modern biographies usually are in chronological order. Ancient biographies could be, but they could also be arranged topically. Modern biographies often will have footnotes. Ancient biographies will usually mention their sources only when there are conflicting sources, and especially if they're writing about things many generations earlier. So you don't expect that in the Gospels, and never in the form of footnotes anyway. But the primary feature is the same in both ancient and modern biographies, and that is that they recount the life or the part of the life of a historic person. Biography in this period was a subtype of the genre of history. The early empire, in fact, actually the period between Cornelius Nepos at the very end of the Roman Republic and probably Diogenes Laertius in the early 3rd century, that was the apex, that was the climax of historiographic accuracy in ancient biographies. So if you're talking about ancient biography, well, you know, in the time of Socrates, it may not have been quite as accurate. And a few centuries after the Gospels, it may not have been quite as accurate. But we're dealing with biographies from the period when biographies were most expected to be historically accurate. Also, the Gospels, unlike most ancient biographies, the Gospels were written from within the period of living memory, which is really going to affect how much credence we should give to how much they would have remembered. Now, novels and history or biography were definitely distinct genres in antiquity. So Polybius, a historian writing a few centuries before the Gospels, emphasized how accurate they needed to be. Some people say, of course historians would say history and biography have to be accurate, but they were biased towards their profession. So I like to cite also some other examples from antiquity. For example, Lucian, who was a satirist writing in the 2nd century AD, he also says, you know, the one feature that is absolutely required and characteristic of biography and history is that it has to be accurate. And Pliny the Younger, who's an orator and a statesman writing in the early 2nd century, says that what's distinctive about history is its concern for accurate facts. You know, as a rhetorician, he also was concerned about rhetoric, but he says, you know, the distinctive feature of history is that it has to be concerned with accuracy. A couple centuries before the Gospels, Aristotle said that the difference between epic poetry, say like Homer's Iliad, and history is not their form, because you could write history in verse if you wanted to, but it's their content, that history must deal with what actually happened. Biographies were mainly a sort of historical writing, contrary to what my first Gospels professor said in my first semester of my doctoral work at Duke. He gave us a syllogism: the Gospels are ancient biography, ancient biographies are fictitious, therefore the Gospels are fictitious. And I said, I don't think that's right. And so I started giving some information, some of which I'm going to cover now, to which his response was, oh, I don't know. I don't know anything about ancient biography. He read it in an article somewhere, which I've since found. So the moral of the story is, don't believe anything any professor tells you, including myself. No, that wouldn't work, but that's why we have to check up on people. So novels were a very different kind of genre back then. They lacked clear historical sources. They certainly didn't have historical prefaces like the Gospel of Luke has. And historians and biographers, sometimes people say, well, it can't be history if it's trying to make a point. History just gives you information. But that's not actually true. Most ancient novels didn't try to make a point. But historians and biographers in antiquity felt a moral responsibility to give you information so that you would know how to live, so you would know how to make wise political or military decisions, and to know how to relate to deity or deities. So those were things that regularly you find in ancient historiography. They say, well, no, the Gospels, look, they're fun to read. They're not like, you know, detailed scholarly history. They're more like novels, some people say. Actually, novels, histories, and biographies were all meant to be engaging to read. That's why people read them. There was a range of historical reliability. And by the way, with novels, most novels in antiquity were romances, which is a feature that seems to me notoriously lacking in the Gospels and Acts. There was a range of historical reliability. Some were more accurate than others. Those who were writing about figures of the recent past, however, usually tended to be most accurate. Josephus is somewhere in between on the scale of very accurate to not very accurate. In his autobiography, he makes himself look suspiciously good. He summarizes the Judean-Roman War as if it were just an accident. But when he writes details, archaeology often confirms him down to details in the architecture of the harbor in Caesarea, or down to details in the way the temple was built. He gets correct the color of paint on Herod's bedroom wall in Masada. I have no idea how he knew that, but he got it right. Full-length biographies often follow a basic chronology. So the person's background and birth, when that was known and relevant, they would, like you do have that in Matthew and Luke, then they would give the person's life, and then they would give the person's death. Now, that's a kind of basic chronology. They didn't require chronology, though, on all the details. In contrast to the multi-volume histories that tried to follow chronology when possible, biographies didn't have to do that, especially biographies of sages, of teachers, because often people didn't remember, okay, this was said on this occasion, this was said on that occasion, this occasion happened here, and this occasion happened there. Those aren't the kind of details we usually remember. So when you see that Matthew and Luke sometimes have things in a slightly different order than each other, or Mark or John, that shouldn't surprise us. That's not something that was required by the genre of ancient biography. So when people say, "Ah, they're inaccurate because of this," that's just nonsense. That's an anachronistic reading, trying to read the Gospels in terms of genres that didn't exist yet in their time. Some ancient biographers, like Suetonius, was especially topical. Philo, in his biography of Moses, rearranges Moses' plagues for topical reasons. So if Matthew sometimes says something in a different sequence from Luke, nobody would have expected otherwise back then. So there was a Protestant theologian named Osiander, and he wanted everything to be in exactly the right order. So to tidy it up, he had Jesus raise Jairus' daughter three times. I mean, that's somebody who was really seriously dead. Calvin thought that was pretty extreme, and Luther was even more flexible than Calvin. But anyway, but my first time through the Gospels, I didn't know all this. You know, I'd just been converted from atheism. I got through Matthew. Hey, this is great. Got through Mark, and it's like, oh, he got crucified again. How often is this going to happen? So I didn't really understand the way. But, you know, our job isn't to figure out, God, you should have inspired it this way. Our job is to say, okay, God, you did inspire it this way. What can we learn from how you did it? But granted that good biographers were substantially accurate, how accurate were they in details? That depends on the biographer. That's not something that you can determine just by genre. But the best way to test them in most cases is that, were they writing about the recent or the distant past? And how closely did they stick to their sources, where we can test them? So with the Gospels, the latest of the Gospels, according to the most common dating, was about 65 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. That's pretty brief by ancient standards, and it's actually within the period of living memory. In terms of testing, by the way, can you all hear me? Hold the mic closer. Yeah, thanks. Is that better? Okay. Or should I hold it? Oh, this good. Okay. Testing, is that too loud? Okay. So testing how closely they stuck to their sources, we need to allow them freedom for rewording things in their own wording. That was standard ancient practice. In fact, if you didn't reword things at all, it was considered plagiarism. And if anybody here is a student, watch out for that. But we did have a graduate of our seminary who was, well, actually didn't graduate, he was expelled for plagiarism. And then he went on to write Pilgrim's Progress and the King James Version of the Bible. No, just joking. But Matthew and Luke closely follow Mark in their common material, by ancient standards, extremely closely. And the differences were well within the range accepted in ancient biography. In fact, if you compare Josephus's account of certain events in his life and Josephus's account of certain events in his war, in his antiquities, there's more tension between Josephus and different passages than there is between John and the Synoptics at times. So what kinds of sources did biographers often use? Well, when they were writing about the distant past, sometimes they said, well, we have to use legends. That's all we have. But when they were writing about the recent past, they interviewed eyewitnesses or people who knew the eyewitnesses when that was available. The best surviving source on Alexander the Great is normally held to be Arrian's 5-volume monograph on Alexander the Great. Now, Arrian was writing about 450 years after Alexander's death. Alexander lived 356 to 323 BC. Now, 450 years before us would be before the United States was a nation. It's a long time ago. It would be a couple centuries before the Declaration of Independence, actually. So think about 450 years in the case of Arrian and Alexander the Great. And then think about the Gospel of Mark, the usual critical dating of which is not 400 years, but 40 years, somewhere around 40 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. So those who are writing about the recent past often depended on eyewitnesses or were eyewitnesses themselves. I mean, when Suetonius writes his biography of Otho that we'll be looking at soon, Suetonius gets some of the information from his own dad, who was a soldier who worked under Otho, the Emperor Othio. So biographies of recent characters, they stayed close to their sources. Their objective was not to invent. It was quite different from novels. And if you take, for example, three works written about half a century later, so within living memory, after the sources that they recount, these three sources about the Emperor Otho. How many of you have heard of Otho? How many of you have heard of Augustus? Yeah, Augustus had a better propaganda machine. He also lived a lot longer. Otho didn't survive as emperor very long. But we have within living memory three works that tell us a lot about Otho. Tacitus's histories, we have Suetonius's biography of Otho, and then Plutarch in his biographies of Otho and Galba give us a lot of information about Otho. So if you compare them in parallel columns, I'm sure you can read the fine print here, and we could actually take up the whole day just going through some of these, but we won't. So this is just to illustrate that I did that. When you get to the end of it, I found about 50 correspondences between Suetonius and each of the other sources, and then a number of other correspondences. So about 75 historical correspondences altogether. Now, Suetonius's biography of Otho is brief. It's only about 28 paragraphs long. It's less than 2,000 words. It's less than one-fifth the length of our shortest gospel, which is Mark's gospel. And that's significant because in this limited amount of space, there are about two historical facts per paragraph where we can confirm what Suetonius is saying based on other sources. What does that tell us? It tells us that a biographer like Otho wasn't making stuff up. He was depending on historical information. Now, that doesn't mean we can confirm everything because, I mean, it's been 2,000 years and most of the sources don't survive. But from the sources that do survive, we can see the nature of ancient biography. And this can be done and illustrated with other ancient biographies as well. So what would we expect with Mark? I mean, with Mark, if we're talking about, you know, Mark being like over five times as long, just according to a purely secular historiographic method, we would expect at least 250 points of correspondence with the data there. So some people say, you trust the canonical gospels because you're biased, because they're canonical. Actually, the reason they're canonical is because they were written about Jesus within living memory and came from the circle of those who knew the eyewitnesses. Those are normal historiographic criteria. It's not Christians who are biased for believing in the gospels. Those who dismiss them because they're in the Bible are the ones who have an anti-canonical bias. If we treat them the way we would treat other historical sources from the period, we would treat them with a great deal more credence and faith. The evangelists likewise used sources rather than made things up. So Matthew and Luke probably depend on the second and third levels of sources below. I'm not sure how well you can see those. There are different opinions on the exact configuration. This is the most common configuration. But whatever view you have on the configuration, the overlap shows that they're not just making things up. They're depending on sources, and they believe it's important to depend on sources. And they're depending on sources that were written not too long before they were writing. So they were in a much better position to know how reliable those sources were than we are. Mark was likely the first of the four Gospels, and according to a source not within living memory of Jesus, but within living memory of Mark, Papias, writing in the early second century, he says that he heard from somebody who actually knew Jesus. Papias says that he heard from an eyewitness of Jesus, so probably in the first century, that Mark was an assistant to Peter, and Mark gave us basically Peter's memory about Jesus. So these were called, in the mid-second century, they were called the memoirs of Peter. Now, I don't think that's his only source, because Peter was missing during most of the Passion. He followed partway, and then he ran off. Most of the other disciples ran off, but there were witnesses for the rest of it, and I'm sure Peter had some chance to catch up with some people after the resurrection. Anyway, but what that means is you've got a source that's basically an eyewitness source in Mark. Then you have other material based on the sayings of Jesus that also early sources say is very reliable. You've also got the fourth gospel, which claims that it's based on an eyewitness source. At least a couple of us think that was John the Apostle. Paul Anderson is leading expert on the reliability of John. So anyway, some people Mark actually, I'm a little biased about Mark right now because I'm writing a commentary on Mark, but for over 1,000 years, Mark was largely neglected because people said, Matthew just recycles everything in Mark. We don't really need Mark because we've got Matthew that covers almost everything Mark says. But Matthew usually abridges the accounts in Mark. They had standardized size scrolls. Mark fills the shorter kind of scroll. Matthew fills a longer size scroll. And so Matthew abridges the accounts to get in more material. But Augustine said, no, Mark is just a condensation of Matthew. And so it's not, you know, you can get everything you need from Matthew. So most scholars today, though, recognize that Mark wrote first. And many of us, at least, believe that he was depending on Peter. There's a difference of opinion on that. But what about the so-called lost gospels? Well, this is really a misnomer. They weren't lost. They were discarded. And there are reasons why they were discarded. I mean, there were some groups here and there through the Roman Empire who said, yeah, we want this gospel or this gospel too. But the mainstream of the church throughout the Roman Empire, from Irenaeus in France to Tatian in Syria by the late second century, they all agreed there are four authoritative gospels. And what made them authoritative is they were actually from the first century. They're the only ones we have surviving from the first century. And they were all from the apostolic circle, either by an eyewitness or by somebody who closely knew an eyewitness. And they also include a lot of Galilean and Judean background that's very significant, which is not the case with the apocryphal gospels and the Gnostic gospels. The other things that tend to be called gospels are really a completely different genre from the first century gospels. So the apocryphal gospels fit the expectations for novels. So they're narrative, like the original gospels, but they're written way beyond living memory. They come from the heyday of novels, the late second and early third century. And there's nothing wrong with novels, but you just need to keep in mind that these are novels and not meant to be biographies. Likewise with the Gnostic gospels. Most of the Gnostic gospels aren't even in narrative form. They're collections of sayings. Now, again, I'm not against collections of sayings. How many of you have ever read Proverbs? Nothing wrong with that. But these sayings were supposedly passed on secretly in Gnostic circles. And people who have to claim that their teaching was passed on secretly are admitting that this was not publicly available information or historically testable information. And most of the Gnostic Gospels include elements of Gnostic thought that can't be shown to exist before the second century. So this is, you know, they don't belong in the same category as the other Gospels. So just to give you an example from one of the apocryphal Gospels, this is the infancy Gospel of Thomas, not to be confused with the regular Gospel of Thomas. But Jesus strikes dead a boy who bumped him. And when the deceased boy's parents complain to Joseph, Jesus strikes them blind, which really annoys his stepdad. When another observer complains because Jesus made clay sparrows on the Sabbath, he claps his hands and the birds fly off. When a child dies accidentally and Jesus gets blamed for it, he raises the child to testify on his behalf. This doesn't sound too much like the first century Gospels, particularly when John 2:11 says, "This beginning of miracles Jesus did in Cana of Galilee." The reception of the canonical Gospels shows us that from very early, I mean, there were some books of the New Testament that were disputed for a while, but the canonical Gospels were not among them. They have traces of Judean and Galilean customs, ideas, and language. Even the local topography of Jerusalem in John's Gospel, more than two decades after Jerusalem's destruction. So the Pool of Siloam, the Pool of Bethesda, all sorts of things that archaeology is uncovering now, it fits what we read about in the Gospel of John. This was not a concern relevant to Gnostic Gospels, who really didn't care about historical information. So what about before the Gospels were written down? What do we know about oral history? Now, there's a difference. We often use the language interchangeably, but in terms of oral historiography, there's a difference between oral history and oral tradition. Oral history comes from the period within living memory. That's the period when either the eyewitnesses are alive or those who knew the eyewitnesses are alive. That's a period of roughly 60 to 80 years. Well, did the first century gospels fit that?
Yeah.
By definition, if they're first century, they would fit that because Jesus' public ministry was somewhere around the year 30. So, you know, you do the math. Even the Gospel of John, it's like 65. It's on the earlier end of, you know, how far living memory normally goes. There were still some eyewitnesses alive, presumably when Mark wrote. If you date Mark around 70, I date Mark a bit earlier than that, but if you date Mark around 70, it's not too long before that when we know from Paul's letters that Peter, John, and James, the brother of Jesus, were leaders in the Jerusalem church and still headquartered in Jerusalem at that time. So there were certainly eyewitnesses alive who could verify or contradict things. Josephus says, you know, oh, there's some people complaining about this, but you know, they waited till after the eyewitnesses were dead to write about it. I wrote while the eyewitnesses were alive and could have contradicted it. Well, the Gospels are in that same kind of a framework. Papias is writing somewhere between, well, actually, sometimes dated his writing as early as 108, sometimes dated as late as writing around 140. But whatever date you give Papias says he got his information earlier. He got it from an eyewitness of Jesus. And so within living memory of the writing of Mark's gospel, he gives us information about that. He says that Mark was Peter's interpreter. He didn't follow Jesus directly, but he followed Peter, who followed Jesus. And Papias is actually probably complaining about Mark, saying, no, we like the oral tradition better. But the information he gives us shows that it should be reliable information by the standards we normally use for historiography. I mean, reliable as best as we can get for ancient sources. Luke 1:1-4 tells us much about the sources available to Luke. In verse 1, he tells us that many had already undertaken to provide an account of these things. Verse 2, he tells us that these are oral sources going back to, well, there were oral sources going back to the eyewitnesses. Verse 3, he may say he confirmed this with his own investigations. Actually, that's how the translations usually put it. The Greek phrase, based on ancient prefaces of historical works in antiquity, may mean not just that he investigated, but that he had thorough acquaintance with it. This was something he knew firsthand. Obviously not, you know, the empty tomb or things going back that far, but we do see in the book of Acts he was around for some of it and was in touch with the people who were there firsthand. And also we see that Luke couldn't fudge. He couldn't just make things up because the material was already widely known in the early church. How many of you were here for my paleobotany lecture last week? You don't remember? I saw you. No, see, I can't persuade you that you were here and you heard something that you didn't hear. By the same standard, Luke couldn't persuade Theophilus. Okay, I'm confirming what you already know, if these weren't things that Theophilus already knew about. This was material that was widely circulated already in the early church by the time Luke wrote. Most scholars date Luke between 60 and 90. There are some who date him later. You can't really date him earlier because the book of Acts ends somewhere around the year 60, 62 or so. But by the time he writes, he says many have already written accounts of this. So that includes Mark, probably includes some material that's shared between Matthew and Luke. But it's not just even two sources. It's a number of sources. And that means that many had written about Jesus' life and teachings already within, and I'm taking a median date, about 45 years after the events. Now, I don't know how many of you here were around 45 years ago. I was. Anybody else? Is there Anybody here who knows somebody who was around 45 years ago? So what if somebody told you that nobody could remember things from 45 years ago? Would that be credible to you? But that's how a lot of more skeptical New Testament scholars take the information. They say, 45 years, nobody could remember something that long. Well, I beg your pardon. Like, what sort of events were happening 40 or 50 years ago? So, was Jimmy Carter ever president? Was Ronald Reagan ever president? Of course, today we have photographs, we have videos, and so on. But if we didn't, I mean, surely somebody still remembers these kind of events. I remember when I was an undergraduate. I still had hair. Not all of us were permanently bald. Luke also, in verse 2, he mentions oral sources. So he mentions what appear to be written sources in verse 1. He mentions oral sources in verse 2. And he mentions that they were handed down. The Greek word paradidomi can mean all sorts of things. It can even mean betray. But in the context of passing on information, it was often used for disciples of teachers passing on information from their teachers. It was used for Pharisaic schools passing on information or traditions from their schools. So it can be in a context of oral tradition or oral history. It's technical language. The question is, how accurate could it be? So there are a couple questions here that often get confused in scholarship. One is psychological memory. How long could individual eyewitnesses remember things? So this is relevant to the first witnesses. And then social memory. This is relevant to the community preserving stories or teachings. Normally, with oral tradition, but not just oral tradition, but even in individual human memory, memories get compacted, blended, with the key points preserved. It's kind of like if you work with posting things online, you can have video compression algorithms that compress videos by reducing redundancy. Well, the human brain does that as well. There are various frailties of memory, and those who are skeptical that the disciples could have remembered anything tend to emphasize these. Suggestibility, so if you have a list of things to remember, somebody will give you a list, you'll see it one time. Sleep, pillow, dreams, and so on. And then later they'll test your memory and they'll throw in the word bed, and you might think bed is part of it. And they'll say, that's a frailty in your memory. Bed wasn't part of it. But bed was the same kind of thing that was in the list. What we tend to remember is not verbatim, word for word. What we tend to remember is the gist. And bed was kind of in the ballpark. They talk about bias. Reconstructed memory tends to favor ourselves, to make us look good. If you've ever read the Gospel of Mark, Peter definitely does not do that. Chronological conflations, you know, you may not know exactly when something happened. You may not get it in exactly the right order. But, you know, birth, life, and death, you'll probably get those in the right order. Memory is rarely verbatim, except maybe for aphorisms, proverbs, haste makes waste, things like that. And usually to get it verbatim, you have to practice it over and over again. But you'll get the gist. You'll remember episodes. So the nature of human memory is we forget more than we remember. How many of you remember what you had for lunch on August 3rd, 2016? You might if you eat the same thing every day or if it was your birthday or something, but chances are most of us aren't going to remember that. How many of you remember all the conversations you had last year? We don't remember everything. That would really overdo the brain. But we remember key events significant to us. Sometimes we'll remember some random details associated with them, but we'll especially remember the gist. If we recount an episode regularly, we'll remember it in its regularly recounted form. By the way, for those of you who think, oh no, he was supposed to speak on Christobiography, this is all in Christobiography, I'm not cheating. So, but of events significant to us, we'll remember only about half of those after 5 years. But whatever you still remember after 5 years generally goes into long-term memory, and you'll remember it for, you know, decades often after that. Obviously, Peter, John, and others would remember many episodes about Jesus. They may not remember everything, but they're going to remember more than enough to fill some Gospels. They may not remember every time Jesus raised something from somebody from the dead, but they'll probably remember the first two or three. and that would get my attention. So you say, why is there a picture of Gilligan's Island up there? When I was age 8, I was in third grade, and I was humming Gilligan's Island. This, if you don't like that, this was before my conversion. But I was humming Gilligan's Island, and the teacher called me out and said, if you're going to hum, you need to sing it in front of the class. And so I did. Well, at my 40th high school reunion, talking with somebody who remembered this event 50 years before, she called her husband over. She said, this is the guy I told you about. And she recounted that event because it was so entertaining to her. I remembered it because I was traumatized. But that's independent memory over the course of 50 years of a certain event that stuck out in our memories for some reason. In our late teens, and early 20s is usually the peak of individual memory. So you especially are going to remember things from that period. Now, most ancient disciples were in their mid to late teens. They were in this period when you would especially remember things. If any of you is in charge of a youth group, keep in mind most of the disciples were teenagers. If any of you wonders why the disciples were acting like they did, most of them were teenagers. So how accurate can oral sources be? Well, this is a picture of Anna Gulick, who was my neighbor, who passed away just a few years ago at the age of 96. And she says that when she was a child, she was born in 1918, they didn't have air conditioning, so they'd sit out in the front porch and just tell stories. They didn't have TV, they didn't have radio, so radio may have existed, but they didn't have one. So they would just sit out on their front porch and tell stories. And they passed down family stories from generation to generation. And she was able to give me information going back in her family as far back as the 1700s. And I was able to check it. I was able to check some of it and confirm it. And so, which she couldn't have done because she was blind by this point. So even in our culture, I mean, today we kind of rely on collective memory, namely Google. But there was a time when education in the U.S. was based mainly on memory. People would memorize long poems and so on. So even in our culture, which is not so memory-centered today in terms of individual memory, there should be a plausibility of people being able to remember things for a long time. That was certainly an emphasis in the Middle East. Kenneth Bailey did a lot about that. It was critiqued by one scholar who said, no, what does Kenneth Bailey know? I consulted with one guy over here. Kenneth Bailey lived in the Middle East for decades, you know, so he did know something. But I consulted with a friend in Lebanon and also with an anthropologist who worked there. You know, there are people who memorize the Quran who don't even speak Arabic. They can memorize the entire Quran. And one of my friends from Lebanon shared with me a poem that he learned growing up, and it was a poem about a poet. She was a princess in the Arabian Peninsula somewhere in the Middle Ages, and she said, whoever is the best poet in my realm, to that person I'll give my hand in marriage, and therefore they will become prince over this realm. So all sorts of poets were coming from different parts of the Arabian Peninsula to recite their poems before her. Well, one guy who was a really good poet, but not very discreet in how he chose his friends anyway, he was traveling with another poet, and the other poet said, "Oh, let me hear your poem." And he recited it, and the other poet said, "That is really good," and then killed him. Because he memorized the poem as he was hearing it, and then he went and recited it before the princess. And how did she respond? She said, "Take this man away. He is my husband's murderer." Because she said, "Ah, this is the best poem," but she could tell by his accent that he wasn't from the same region that the poem originated from based on its topographic. She was a good, critical biblical scholar, right? So, but people could memorize things just while they were hearing them. And in terms of how accurate this could be in the Roman Empire, well, we need to look at a few points here. Memorization in antiquity, the taking of notes, the evidence for Aramaic rhythm in the Gospels. I'm going to spend more of the time on memorization in antiquity, or not verbatim memorization, but being able to remember things. And the prominence of eyewitnesses in the church. So people didn't have that much room to make up things in the first century. So memorization. You had storytellers, bards, who were considered uneducated. They were often illiterate, but they could recount the entire Iliad and Odyssey by heart. Orators, one of the five basic tasks of oratory was memorizing your speech and being able to deliver it from memory without notes. I'm cheating, I'm using my PowerPoint, but they didn't normally use PowerPoint. So they would memorize. Sometimes these speeches were hours in length. Elementary education, it was the most basic feature of elementary education. And then beyond elementary education, you had disciples of teachers. In some contexts, their memory would have to be primarily oral. Some contexts, it would have to be primarily based on written sources. You could have either one. And people would remember not just the sayings of the teacher, but they would also often remember the deeds. It could be used as legal precedent. Actually, later rabbis would say, "This can't be wrong because Rabbi so-and-so did it." They would learn the deeds. In fact, it's said that there was this one rabbi who was getting ready to make love to his wife and found a disciple under his bed and said, "What are you doing under my bed?" To which the disciple replied, "It is said that we must learn everything from the example of our teacher." If I find any of you under my bed, you will be in big trouble. But the Pythagoreans were the extreme example of this. It was said that they weren't allowed to get out of bed in the morning until they could repeat back everything their teacher told them the day before. So tomorrow morning, you're going to be quizzed on all this. No. So Homeric epics, intellectuals looked down on these professional reciters, these bards, who could count these stories. Giving an example of carefully trained memories, Seneca the Elder, if you've heard of Seneca the philosopher, this was his dad. He says, "When I was young, my memory was really good, but now I'm old and so I can't remember things as well. But when I was young, I could meet 2,000 people and then repeat back their names in exactly the order in which I'd heard them. You could give me 200 verses, and I could repeat them back in reverse order." So he talks about how good his memory was, but he says, "Now I'm old, but you know all these famous speakers? I went to school with them. We all went to oratory school together." And how many of you have had homiletics? How many of you can remember all the practice speeches by all your colleagues in the class? Me neither. I remember my own, but that was because it was another traumatic experience. But he then proceeds to give excerpts from over 100 of these practice speeches from his colleagues, from memory, from decades earlier. Now, he was extraordinary. He was like the kind of person who memorizes a phone book to get in Guinness Book of World Records. But you have other people, like somebody who went to an auction, and at the end of the day, he could repeat back every item that was sold, the price for which it was sold, the person to whom it was sold, with no notes, because they trained their memories that carefully. Memory can do a lot if you really train it. Anybody here, if you're a student, keep that in mind for your midterms. Your professors can have high expectations. Anyway, but another person went to a poetry reading, and the person up front was reading the poem, and the person in the back said, "Wait a minute, that's my poem. You stole it. I can prove it." And then repeated back from memory the poem to prove it. And while the person up front was so discomfited, the person in the back said, "Just joking. I memorized it while you were reading it. I just wanted to show how good my memory was." So memory can be very accurate if it's carefully trained. So hopefully you will remember all this over the lunch break.
And that's where we broke for lunch. But don't worry, you don't have to wait an hour like we did in person. Part 2 of Dr. Keener's talk is available right now on the Together PDX podcast. Thanks for listening.